Hello, I'm Brent. Yes, this is number 0117, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0117. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet actress Michael Learned, best known for her role as the matriarch on The Waltons. She's still moved even today by the response she gets from people who love that show.
It was really very humbling to see how much The Waltons has meant to people. You know, people would come up to me with tears in their eyes, and it touches your heart, you know.
Piers Gibbon, whose new documentary on National Geographic is called The Witch Doctor Will See You Now. What are some of the odd things he's experienced doing on the show that he could do without?
A yogic cleansing ceremony called rubber neti, which involves a little tiny rubber tube being shoved up your nose so far that it comes out the back of your throat, and then you have to take both ends of it. So you've got one end in one hand, one end in the other, and you're basically flossing your own sinuses, and it feels like flossing your own brain. And I don't want to ever do that again. Really, never. Don't make me.
David A. Gibb is the author of Camouflage Killer. It's the story of serial killer Colonel Russ Williams. Does David believe that there is some evil in all of us?
I honestly believe that there is evil at the root of all of us. And we've just been conditioned, we've been taught to suppress those urges. I mean, most of us have homicidal thoughts or what could be described as flamboyant fantasies throughout our lives, but we have learned since our youth to control them and to keep them just as thoughts in our head. But there are those people who just don't have those control mechanisms, and what they think, they act as.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0117, is Brent Shias, the director of Just for Laughs television content. He's also responsible for their radio content, which gives me the chance to mention that another series of Just for Laughs radio shows on XM Radio, XM Satellite Radio, is getting ready to air, a show that I produce and also host. Satellite subscribers who are on XM can go online and check their listings for times and air dates. And thank you very much, Brent, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 21-year-old Leonard Tyrell Young was cut from the Fresno Pacific University basketball team and didn't exactly take it very well. After being told he was being kicked off, Young allegedly ran naked through a convenience store parking lot, tried to steal a police car, beat a police officer and police dog, and withstood 3 taser strikes before finally being subdued. He's now charged with carjacking, resisting arrest, vandalism, harming a police dog, and, not surprisingly, being under the influence of a controlled substance. Reportedly, he was dismissed from the team for a violation of team standards. Imagine that. You know, some people are just, well, sore losers, I guess. Okay, warning, folks. Disturbing graphic material ahead. In Portland, Oregon, 21-year-old Elizabeth Herrick and her boyfriend Joshua Washburn have been caring for a 32-year-old horse in declining health. Now, when it became evident the horse had no quality of life left, they put the animal down with a single gunshot. That's not uncommon, and some would even say the humane thing to do. It's what happened next that has people shocked and horrified. The couple then gutted the dead horse, and Elizabeth took off all of her clothes, climbed inside the carcass, and took photos. She then posted them online. She's now been barraged with an avalanche of criticism that led to a police investigation for animal cruelty. Along with the bizarre carcass photos, there are others which appear to depict the couple posing with the animal's heart. They also later ate the horse. The couple told authorities that they simply wanted to feel one with the horse and nature. However, after investigating, Washington County detectives ruled no charges would be filed against the pair since nothing they did is technically illegal in the state of Oregon. Elizabeth's mother told reporters that since the incident, they have received death threats and hostile contact from people countrywide, accusing Herrick of everything from Satan worship to perversion. So, for the time being, Elizabeth and Josh have left the state temporarily. I really don't have anything to add to that story. So let's just move on, shall we? In Malone, New York, in September, Clyde Gardner, age 57, was sentenced to 5 to 15 years in prison for trying to murder his ex-girlfriend twice. Initially, he was going to dress in a recently skinned bear hide, walk on its paws so as not to leave any shoe prints, and maul her with the claws. After abandoning that plan, he promised a friend $15,000 to kill the woman in a car crash, and since Gardner was a demolition derby driver, he offered expert instructions, though the friend turned Gardner in. You know, this is yet another person who clearly shops from the same Acme catalog that Wile E. Coyote uses. Anyway, finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, police in Vandalia, Ohio, have arrested 44-year-old Terry Trent after he allegedly broke into a family's residence, made himself at home, and put up Christmas decorations. According to police, an 11-year-old child came home and found a stranger sitting on the couch. His mother, Teresa Henderson, was next door, so he called her. Trent apparently walked through the back door, made himself comfortable on the couch, turned on the TV, and did some holiday decorating. Henderson said at least the man tried his best to be polite to her 11-year-old son, saying, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to scare you. I'll get my things and go." According to police, Trent has a history of drug charges, and they believe he was high on bath salts at the time. Well, at least he was in the holiday spirit, wasn't he? Yes. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Four-time Emmy Award-winning actress Michael Learned is best known for the role that brought her three of those Emmys. She played the matriarch Olivia Walton in the hit CBS series The Waltons. In December, there is going to be a reunion of some of the cast members to mark the 40th anniversary of the TV movie The Homecoming that spawned the show. Michael Learned will be there in New Jersey. But that's not all she's doing. She continues to be a very busy actress with a very busy career, which is why we're honored that she's taken a little time to talk to us right now. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Peter. Thank you. That's very sweet of you.
Thanks for being on with us. You, as I said in the introduction, very, very busy. Not only do you have this reunion coming up, and not only have you kept working all these years, you're currently working on The Young and the Restless.
I am. At the moment, I'm stepping in for Jeannie Cooper, who has had an upper respiratory infection. So she's recuperating from it. She had a very heavy schedule, and I guess she felt it was best to just take it easy for a little while and come back when she's really strong again. So I'm stepping in, not filling her shoes by any means, because no one could. But it's been an experience, I'll tell you. I'll start a scene with somebody and say, "Do I know you? Are you my son? Are you my lover? Are we friends? Are we enemies?" Because, you know, I don't know the backstories of any of these storylines. So it's been a real experience.
But you're not new to the world of daytime drama. You've done General Hospital and All My Children in the past, correct?
Well, All My Children, it was just a two-day thing where I played a judge. And General Hospital was a character that was just on her own. It wasn't part of a storyline. Her storyline was just hers. I played someone who had cancer, and but Jeannie Cooper is involved in. I mean, Kay Chancellor is involved in everybody's life on that series. On that there are a lot of storylines to try to follow and catch up on, and everybody's been wonderfully helpful. It's been actually fun, but a little harrowing at the same time.
I would assume it's a little bit of a different acting muscle to be in a daytime drama like that.
You know, my hat's off to those people. I told them, I said, "You guys are warriors." You know, you'd go in and you get a script just before you have to play a scene sometimes, or the night before, and boom, out there they go, and they do a damn good job, I think.
Well, let's go back a little bit to those series that won you multiple Emmys, three Emmys for The Waltons and one Emmy for Nurse. It's almost hard to believe it's 40 years ago.
Can you believe that? I can't. My kids grew up on it.
Yeah. A lot of people.
And so did I.
Yeah. Exactly. You have a reunion coming up in December. Do you keep in touch with a lot of the cast and crew over the years?
Absolutely. We're like an extended family. We really are. We're very close. We get together as often as we can. And of course, we all have our other lives, but we look forward to whenever there's a reunion or anything that we get to do, because we have so much fun together. And those kids are like my own kids. I mean, they grew up with me, really.
And I understand you do keep in contact with some of the crew, including Ralph Waite. Since we're in Canada, I should mention you are actually coming to Canada next year with Ralph in Love Letters.
That's right. We're going to do it in a town called Petrolia. Do you know that? Do you know where that is?
Near Sarnia, I believe.
Yeah, and I guess a couple of hours out of Toronto, but it's a cute little town. And I was there summer before last and worked for the Starbright Company, and I had a wonderful time. It's a wonderful company, and I kind of felt like I was back at the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco, where I spent many years in a rep company, and you know, it has that wonderful feeling of vibrance and exuberance and hard work and great talent. So it's a great company to be part of.
Well, what do you prefer, stage or television?
Well, I like the money in television. To be honest, stage is where it's what I trained for, and it's where I feel ultimately most comfortable, I think.
There is
the toilets are cleaner.
There is a special category in the world for television moms, so it must feel good to you to play such an iconic role as you did on The Waltons, which is one of the great moms in TV.
It sure is. I mean, just to have been part of the show. When I was in Canada summer before last doing Driving Miss Daisy for the Starbright company, you know, they have a tradition where you meet where the audience meets the cast afterwards. You come out through the audience and meet people in the lobby, and it was really very humbling to see how much the Waltons has meant to people. You know, people would come up to me with tears in their eyes, and it touches your heart. You know,
when you read the scripts when you first worked on the show, did you get a sense that the role and the show would become what it has become?
We had no idea. I had no idea. I thought it would just be an American. I had done a lot of work in Canada because, you know, I lived in Toronto for a long time, and but I hadn't done any television in the United States. I'd only been working at the American Conservatory Theater. And so I thought this would be my first American TV credit. And I thought that was great. But I never thought it would run for more than two or three episodes. And it was stunning how it turned my life around. Literally stunning.
Now, you were a full-time member of the cast for most of the run, but not necessarily near the end. You did do some guest starring appearances, I believe, near the end, right? But you weren't a regular.
No, I, you know, once the kids were grown, there wasn't much left for me to do. And to sit around for 14 hours and pour coffee say, pass the salt, please, I just couldn't do it anymore. And I didn't feel it was really quite the same show. You know, I think in the States we tend to keep shows on a little too long. But I was very proud and am still proud and humbled to have been part of it at all.
Many.
And I mean that because, you know, when I was young, I was, you know, when you're young, you're sort of arrogant. You don't have a clue. And as you get older and you look back on those wonderful days and what a great gift it was.
Many actors, especially women, of a certain age, if they have a role that they've had for a long time, they get typecast. You managed to go right into another show not too long after and win another Emmy, Nurse.
Well, that was lucky, and I loved that show. It was difficult. We were shooting in New York, and it was a very difficult show because the writers were in Los Angeles writing for New York. So it was a little tough, but I think it had great promise, and I'm sorry that it was canceled. I think it had some good stories and some wonderful actors and writers, New York writers and stuff. So that was disappointing, but it was really nice to get an Emmy. That was great. I didn't expect it. It was nice.
Where do you keep all your Emmys?
I have a little study upstairs, and they're in the bookshelf. I hide them. I used to keep them outside because somebody said they get a really nice patina, but they don't, so I don't keep them outside anymore.
Now, I understand that you spending time here in Canada, you also spent some time in Austria?
I did. I was there in just after the war in 1950 when it was still occupied by the Russians, the Americans, and the English. And we lived in a tiny little village, and I went to school in the little village and learned to speak German and wore dandals. And it was, you know, I think there were two cars in the entire village. And my father was working for the OSS. In other words, he was a spy and later worked for the CIA. And so it was interesting, to say the least, for me. It was a little bit like The Sound of Music, honest to God. It was sitting on a hill making daisy chains and harmonizing with the local kids. It was great.
You just didn't have to wear the drapes, right?
No. And then there were all those, there's all that other stuff was going on at the same time. You know, all the political stuff with the Russians and the Cold War and all that stuff. But I was 11 years old, so I wasn't interested in any of that stuff. I was just interested in boys and, what 11-year-olds are interested in.
When did your interest go to acting?
Well, I was shipped off to boarding school in England, primarily for dance. And so I went to boarding school in England from Austria, and I accidentally, I think, won a drama cup in the school, competition. And so they said, you're not really a very good dancer. Why don't you become a special drama student? So that's what I did. And so, that's kind of how it happened.
So flash forward to the work you've been doing and the work you've done in the Waltons. As I mentioned, a 40th anniversary coming up in December. I'm sure there's always talk of, will there be another movie? So I have to ask the question, will there be another movie, a TV movie, a reunion?
I hope not, actually. I think I'd rather leave it the way people want to remember it in its early stages. I think it's really sad to have these constant movies of the week where everybody's, I'll be in a walker by then. So I hope there's no, I don't look forward to another movie of the week.
Is there anything in your career that you haven't done that you'd like to?
No, not really. I mean, I've been very lucky. I've had a family life and a career as well, and I'm married to a gorgeous sweetheart of a man, and, I'm a very lucky person, I think. I was telling somebody earlier that I really didn't deserve to get the Waltons. I wasn't ready for it. I didn't want it, and it turned my life around, and it was a great gift that I didn't deserve, but I'm grateful that I was given it.
And I think I speak for most of the fans. We're grateful that you got the part. I thank you very, very much, Michael, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Actress Michael Learned, best known for her role as Olivia Walton on The Waltons. Currently, she's filling in for Jeannie Cooper as Catherine Chancellor on The Young and the Restless. And she'll be in New Jersey on December 2nd for the Waltons reunion. And if you're making plans to visit Southern Ontario next summer, she'll be doing Love Letters with her TV hubby Ralph Waite at the Starbright Theatre in Petrolia in August. For information, you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0117, and you'll find links to all the events.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll meet Piers Gibbon from National Geographic's The Witch Doctor Will See You Now. Plus, we'll also meet the author of Camouflaged Killer, The Shocking Double Life of Colonel Russ Williams. And of course, there will be an idiot of the day. But right now, more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. In what has to be one of the all-time dumbest reasons to ever end up in prison, police in Pennsylvania have arrested two adult men for stealing a meatball sandwich from a 13-year-old boy at gunpoint. No kidding. The duo threatened the teenager with a gun and told him to empty his pockets. One of the robbers, a 21-year-old, pointed his gun at the boy and allegedly said, "Whatever you do, don't move. If you do anything, I'll cap you." They took his meatball sandwich but didn't bother taking his mobile phone before fleeing in a nearby car, so the young victim promptly used his phone to call 911. Police were able to quickly find and arrest the sandwich robbers. Police said they recovered a gun and they recovered the sandwich. You know, that must be one really good meatball sandwich. And believe it or not, these two clowns are not the idiot of the day. That comes later. Okay, talk about a bad sign of the times, or at least a sad sign of the times. Facing the daunting budget problems in a down economy, officials in New York's Suffolk County said they had no choice but to sack Santa Claus. Steve Levy, the Suffolk County executive, said he just couldn't justify paying $660 from his $2.7 billion budget to pay 83-year-old David McKell, a World War II vet and former homicide detective, to don his Santa suit for the 10th year running and greet children on Long Island. Levy was quickly labeled a Grinch by his opponents, including Bill Lindsay, the presiding officer of the county legislature, who said, "Do we really have to hold Santa hostage to balance the budget? I mean, $600. Give me a break." In the meantime, county officials said dozens of people have come forward offering to pay for Santa's services, and Levy himself volunteered to don a Santa suit for a shift or two. In the end, Steve Bellone, who is running as the Democratic candidate to succeed Levy, said he would pay for Santa. Levy, who is not running for re-election, dismissed Bellone's gesture as pure grandstanding and said his office was investigating whether the check breached rules governing gifts to county agencies. Oh, come on, really? You know, it seems to be that Democrats and Republicans will fight over anything these days, even Santa. Okay, yet another story for the political correctness crowd, or at least political correctness in the courts gone mad. Germany may be the only county in Europe that knows how to run their finances, but they've got a ways to go in their justice department. A state court in Frankfurt just awarded $4,000 to 36-year-old Magnus Gafgen on his claim that during a 2002 police interrogation, officers threatened violence against him if he did not disclose what he knew about a missing 11-year-old boy. The boy was later found dead, and the following year, Gavegan was indeed convicted of the boy's murder and is now serving a life sentence. However, the court still thought he should be compensated for his pain and suffering during the interrogation. They didn't beat him. They didn't use violence. They merely threatened violence. Okay, I'm sorry. He murdered a boy and we're supposed to be concerned about his pain and suffering? What about the kid's parents' pain and suffering? Just asking, okay? Wow. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police in Moscow have a pretty grisly case on their hands. A 45-year-old Russian historian was known for his fascination with the dead and eagerly described how he loved to rummage through cemeteries, studying gravestones to uncover the life stories behind them. What he didn't mention was that he had apparently dug up 29 bodies and taken them back to his apartment, where he dressed them in women's clothing and put them on display. A police video of the man's apartment shows his macabre collection of what looks like dolls, their hands and faces wrapped in what appears to be cloth. Police said they were mummified remains and refused to name the suspect arrested last week, but strangely released photographs of him. This made it easy for the media to identify the man as Anatoly Moshkvin, a historian who was considered the ultimate expert on cemeteries in the city of Nizhny Novgorod. Police said he had photographs and nameplates from grave sites he robbed, which could help with the identification of the remains. Moshkvin said that when he was 12, he came across a funeral procession whose participants forced him to kiss the face of a dead 11-year-old girl. Oh, so there's the source of all this. Well, it's still pretty weird. As a matter of fact, I think that gets a big 10 on the ick factor. Anyway, speaking of ick, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Piers Gibbon travels the world in a brand new series for National Geographic that explores strange medicines and health practices. These practices will make you appreciate the medicine we use today. The new documentary is called The Witch Doctor Will See You Now. It's being shown worldwide on National Geographic this month. And Piers Gibbon is on the line with us right now from New York City. Hi, Piers.
Hi there.
With all the things you've done, this show, Head Shrinkers of the Amazon, Dining with Cannibals, I have to ask, you must have the world's greatest insurance company.
Yes, well, actually, it is all about healthcare, because in the United Kingdom, not everyone has healthcare insurance. And in fact, I am a child of the National Health Service, so I don't have any health insurance, which is probably a good idea, because if I did, they would be putting my premiums up right now.
Now, what kinds of things did you see in For the Witch Doctor Will See You Now that literally curled your hair?
Well, I think some of the nastiest things are what you can see on the show tonight. Things like the more extreme end of yoga. It's a yogic cleansing ceremony called rubber neti, which involves a little tiny rubber tube being shoved up your nose so far that it comes out the back of your throat, and then you have to take both ends of it. So you've got one end in one hand, one end in the other, and you're basically flossing your own sinuses, and it feels like flossing your own brain. And I don't want to ever do that again. Really, never. Don't make me.
Okay, so you don't want to do it again, but I have to ask, does it actually work?
Well, it certainly cleared out my sinuses, and there was blood in the basin to prove it. But I think that one I have to mark down to, no, that's not for me, and I don't believe there's much science behind that. It felt too aggressive. And I think with The Witch Doctor Will See You Now, this is what we came up against again and again. Some of the therapies feel like a bit more like a religious ceremony, like when people are slaughtering chickens on our behalf in Cameroon, and some of them feel like there's some weight behind it, some actual science where it actually seems to work, like with tongue acupuncture in China, and like with a hallucinogenic potion called ayahuasca in Peru. I think those are the ones that are really worth looking at again, and I think that's the power of The Witch Doctor Will See You Now, is that Western medicine, yeah, it's brilliant, and I love the science, But I think maybe there's some other things we could learn from other ancient traditions around the world.
Well, is Western science in any way, shape, or form taking notice, at least maybe from a distance, to some of the things that you've discovered in the show?
Yes, and this is the interesting thing. We did the research before, and then I also checked things out again when I got back from the expedition. And just taking one example, in Peru, I was drinking this hallucinogenic potion called ayahuasca, and I got back home and did some research on it and found that actually Western medicine has had a multidisciplinary and extensive look at ayahuasca drinkers. And they found that, they took one population of people who were drinking ayahuasca every Friday night and one population of people who weren't, and they found that the people who were drinking it were healthier, happier, and even a little bit wealthier, I remember. And it's like, oh, that is interesting. A potion that we decide in the West is an illegal drug that we are putting into the category marks, you use this, we put you in jail. In South America, it's regarded as a national treasure, and even our medical white coat guys are looking at it and going, well, it seems to be at least not harmful, and possibly just a little bit of the data is showing that it might actually be healthy.
Well, besides some of the things that you've learned that you really don't have any basis of theory and don't work, were there things you discovered that actually potentially can do harm?
Yes, I think there's a lot of stuff. I mean, like the rubber netty tube up the nose thing, I think that could actually cause you a little bit of harm if you've got a pre-existing sinus condition. They say that's exactly when you should do it. I felt that's just too invasive and aggressive, and it's just not nice. Other things that could do harm, well, I think most of the stuff that didn't feel like it was working perhaps didn't shade over into doing harm, but just felt like it was harmful to other beings. So there's things where we are having chickens slaughtered, and people are slaughtering goats in order to wash us down with the blood to give us spiritual protection. I think that wasn't harmful for me, but it was certainly harmful for the little goat.
Now, in this world that we live in of traditional scientific medicine, we're seeing more and more uses of, shall we say, alternative types of medicines. Having gone through this experience and traveled around the world and seen what you've seen, how readily acknowledging are you of alternative medicines for yourself should the need arise?
Very good question. And I am a bit of a skeptic. So I come from, I have a science degree, and I feel like I'm all in favor of double-blind trials published in peer-reviewed journals. And I still am. But I now am taking a lot more care of my health than I was before the expedition. There was something about meeting all of the healers from around the world, again and again hearing the same things about, the mind and the body are one, and we should take care of who we are and how we are in the world. And I'm now actually, I'm going to Pilates twice a week, and I'm actually going to acupuncture once a week. Now, I'm still not sure I believe I understand how the acupuncture works, but I think it is working.
What is the difference, if any, in lifespans of the people you dealt with in the strange world of medicine? What's their lifespan like as opposed to us in the Western world?
Yeah, I think if you looked at their health in terms of that stark statistic of how long do they live, then you would be forced to draw the conclusion that Western traditional medicine with white coats is the winner. However, it's always difficult to tease out the different effects of whether it's the medicine or whether, and to be honest, I think a lot of opinion would be with me on this, that it's a lot to do with sanitation and other things as well. And the medical care that is available is also hugely important. And, when you're doing sort of a little sort of razor slashing, bloodletting operations in the middle of a very dusty, dirty street in India, you can really understand that we are very lucky that we work in more sterile environments when we're having anything like that done, because bloodborne diseases or airborne bits of nastiness landing on your newly cut legs, that is never going to be healthy for a human being. The question is the bloodletting healthy? And whilst I always feel good when I donate blood at the center, I think that's more that I feel good because I'm doing a nice thing for other people in, in my country, we don't get paid for it. It's just an altruistic act. I don't think possibly that actually letting blood out of a normal human being is a good idea.
Now, you, with other shows you've done in the past, most recently, I guess, with Dining with Cannibals, I mean, you had the danger of worrying about someone actually wanting to eat you. This may be not as dangerous, but you had some dangers along the way, and I understand you even got arrested during this particular series?
Yes, I did get arrested. I still maintain I hadn't done anything wrong, but it was in Cameroon, and the healer there decided that our patient this week, who suffered from anxiety, and he decided that the best thing to do for anxiety would be to dig a shallow grave and lay her in this shallow grave and surround her with a pool of freshly slaughtered chicken's blood. And at that point, the police arrived with guns and started getting very angry with us. And they thought we were killing somebody. So I have to confess that at that point our patient's anxiety level started rising again, and they didn't really slow down because we were taken into custody for 5 hours and questioned at gunpoint, which I think it's a fairly good thing that we can now establish that AK-47 therapy is not a good thing for anxiety.
When it comes to the various doctors you've come across in doing this particular show, how much of it do you think is tradition that goes generations with these certain people, as opposed to someone who just seems to be doing this coming up from the seat of their pants type medicine?
That's a very good question. How do you tell whether the healer you're working with is someone who is whose heart is in the right place and who's really learnt the tradition? That is one thing that I'm very glad of that we have in the West. We have medical school, and you go there, and you do not get to be called the title doctor until you've passed all of the exams at the end of your 4 years or 7 years of medical training. In Cameroon, the title doctor is actually given to you by the community. So it's one of those things where, it's peer-reviewed, yes, and you don't get to call yourself a doctor unless everyone around you agrees that you are a doctor, but still, you've not perhaps passed any exams to get there. You've passed the exams of the street, as it were, and you've healed enough people in the community to be allowed to call yourself a doctor. But there is that gap where you have to be very careful, and this is something I think if we do bring these therapies into the West, I think we need to be very careful that we that they're regulated and that we are making sure that the right people are doing them and doing them carefully.
Well, you know, the most popular singer doesn't always win American Idol, and that's a popularity vote, too, by the community. So
there you go.
The show is called The Witch Doctor. We'll see you now. It's on National Geographic this month. And, Piers, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Piers Gibbon from National Geographic's The Witch Doctor will see you now. Check your local listings to find out where it's showing in your neck of the woods. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0117, and you'll find links to the National Geographic website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Ready for the cold and flu season? Like it or not, sore throats are heading our way, and many of us will soon be reaching for our favorite medicines. It's easy to take these medicines for granted, but if not for a lot of research and clinical studies, we wouldn't even have them. I thought about this after hearing what a respected university had to endure after conducting one of these studies. A woman who'd volunteered for their study sued them after getting a rash. Problem is, she had been warned ahead of time that she might get a rash. But there's more. She hadn't even been given the medicine. She received the placebo. Let's be fair. Scientists won't be able to hold clinical studies anymore if volunteers can sue them after getting a side effect they'd been warned about. This lawsuit over a rash is a reminder that it's time we deal with another sort of rash. The rash of lawsuits making it harder for scientists to keep us healthy. Find out more. Go to our website at centerforamerica.org.
In the air on China Airlines, on the air on stations in Singapore, New Zealand, and America, and streaming through your computer. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to David A. Gibb, the author of Camouflage Killer, The Shocking Double Life of Colonel Russ Williams. We'll also have for you an idiot of the day. But before we get to all of that, one more Stuff File news story before we get to our next guest. Apparently, the good citizens of Montague, Michigan would rather have a dead guy for mayor than his challenger. Sadly, 84-year-old Mayor Henry Rosler Jr. lost his battle with cancer 1 week before the election while he was seeking his 11th consecutive term. But apparently, voters would rather have him, even dead, than his 32-year-old challenger, Kevin Erb. Final tally, Rosler got 129 votes, Erb only 115. But per state law, votes cast for a deceased person don't count. You'd think they wouldn't need a law for that, but anyway. So Mr. Erb will serve the 2-year term. Erb previously ran unsuccessfully against Rosler in the 2009 mayoral race. You know, even though you got the job, how low is your self-esteem when you know that you were beaten by a dead guy? Maybe during the last week of the campaign, he should have put up signs saying, "Vote for me! I'm the one with the pulse." Just an idea. On to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Camouflaged Killer is the disturbing true account of one of Canada's highest-ranking military officers who became the country's most notorious criminal. David A. Gibb is the man who has written the book. Again, the book is Camouflaged Killer, the shocking double life of Colonel Russ Williams. David is on the line with us right now. Hi, David.
How are you doing, Peter?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. This is a story that... if you were to put it into a film or a book as fiction, some people might not believe it, but it was true. Did you ever think something like this could actually take place with such a character?
Not a chance. This is, as you say, it's a story that is stranger than fiction. To imagine this having been written by somebody would be unfathomable. Just the elements into the story as to... never before has anyone in such a public position of authority ever been exposed as a Jekyll and Hyde-type character, serial killer, and sex predator. In order to find someone so high up, so high-ranking in the military, who was exposed that way, you'd have to go back to the days of Joan of Arc. And just, I mean, the other elements of the story, I mean, the attempt to frame his next-door neighbor, the police almost interrupting one of his sex murders. It's unbelievable that it's actually a true story. And so many people have commented that the book just reads like a scary novel.
What was it that led you to draw out more of this story, more than we had seen in the press at the time?
What actually happened was I was hired at the time. I've been a private investigator for 25 years of my life before becoming an author and writer. And I was hired at the time to serve Colonel Williams with legal papers for a civil lawsuit that was being initiated by his first sexual assault victim. She was suing him for $2.45 million, which is still an ongoing lawsuit right now. And I was the one who attended at the prison to serve him with these documents. And during the course of the 25 years I've been in this business, I've relied on my instinct, on my ability to feel when I'm in danger and when there's dangerous elements around me. And so far, it's kept me safe over the years. But what was unnerving was the fact that I stood eyeball to eyeball with Colonel Williams, two feet in front of him, and I felt no threat whatsoever, no sense of evil, no sense of nefarious person standing that close to me. And I had seen evil many times before and got a good sense of it, but he just flew straight under my radar, and I found that very unnerving. So I just I was compelled at that point to dig further and find out how somebody was able to do that, to manipulate people, fly under their radar. I mean, not just me. I mean, we're talking about the two prime ministers of Canada, the chief of defense staff, the minister of defense, the Queen of England, lots of people who would normally have some spidey senses tingling, but in this case, he flew under everybody's radar. So in the process of digging and getting some of these answers, I just realized there was a fascinating, compelling book here that answered the questions how and why, something that hadn't been addressed by the by the press, by the media over the past year or so.
Is part of the problem the fact that we as a society, at least in our minds, like to imagine evil in not such a proper, upright, good-looking, positive role model package?
Well, for sure. I mean, that's we're taught from a young age that this is what bad guys look like. This is what evil looks like, and we were deceived as youngsters because, I mean, in the case of Colonel Williams, he's the very man that we'd be instructed to run to in a time of trouble, and in fact, we'd be running into the arms of a serial killer and sex predator. So people remain convinced that they are able to see evil. And, I mean, long, stringy hair and pot-marked face and rotten teeth. I mean, this is just stereotypes. And obviously, Colonel Williams has shown us, this has been a wake-up call to all of us, that it doesn't matter what your position, your status in society is, you can be as much a risk, if not more, than the person who looks, who fits a stereotypical mold.
Is part of the scary thing in this whole story for the rest of us in the world the fact that evil could literally be living right next door and you not know it?
Well, for sure. And in his case, it was. There are people who can actually say that. I mean, one of his next-door neighbors, an older retired fellow, he was having his granddaughters dropped off by the school bus in front of his house because him and their mother thought it was too dangerous to be let off on the corner where they normally would have been let off the bus. So, in effect, he was. They were having the two girls, two young girls who were later the ages that Williams targeted in some cases, dropped off right in front of the house of a serial killer sex predator. So the irony is just remarkable. And you know, it's true that I mean he was. He was your quintessential military man, polished, proud, calm, cool, even keeled, and respected and revered. And he was one of the most trusted men in the military. So to think he was capable of this, it certainly is a scary predicament to wonder who's living next door.
People are always looking for a reason, looking for a cause. Is there anything in this man's makeup that could be some sort of trigger for this? Or any explanation, or is there just none?
Well, I went to great lengths speaking to people who have known him since his childhood, and pretty much the response was the same across the board, that he did not seem unnormal in any way. He just seemed like a regular guy. I mean, with some issues. I mean, he was a wallflower in high school, and they were different comments like that, but certainly nothing that a lot of us regular folk can compare to as well. So that was what was additionally unnerving, is the fact that so many people had considered him normal. And as far as we know, as far as the record indicates so far, he didn't start committing criminal offenses until the age of 44, which is highly unusual for sexual criminals. So what triggered it at such a late age is still up for debate. I present different theories in the book after consulting with top experts in the field of criminal profiling and forensic psychiatry. But what was particularly interesting was he was taking a drug called prednisone, which is used for he was experiencing severe arthritis. And some of the possible side effects of that drug include lowered inhibitions, higher sexual drive, hypersexuality, feelings of invincibility, and the willingness to take on risks that one normally wouldn't. So the experts tend to think that they may have had a contributing factor to lowering his control mechanisms to the point where the beast, so to speak, came out. It didn't create the beast, but it unleashed, possibly had a role in unleashing the beast inside.
And that so, brings us to the question, is there a beast in all of us?
Well, personally, I believe there is. From the people I've met during the course of my business over the past quarter of a century, I honestly believe that there is evil at the root of all of us. And we've just we've been conditioned, we've been taught to suppress those urges. I mean, most of us have homicidal thoughts or what could be described as flamboyant fantasies throughout our lives, but we have learned since our youth to control them and to keep them just as thoughts in our head. But there are those people who just don't have those control mechanisms, and what they think, they act out.
You mentioned earlier you came into contact with Russell Williams through your investigations. Have you since had an opportunity to come in contact with him, or is he aware of the fact that you have written this book?
I have written to him in the prison twice and not received a response. Now, his mail, of course, is screened by the prison prison officers, and whether or not he's even seen these letters, I have no idea. I have a feeling they're Paul Bernardo, a similar type sexual predator and serial killer, is being held in the same facility, and he has challenged the authorities over the years, leaking information out, and I think they've learned the ropes in dealing with the likes of Williams and Bernardo, and I believe they're holding them in a media blockade there. I don't think they want any media talking to them right now. And then certainly beyond the media, there have been many psychiatrists, psychologists who have angled towards trying to score an in-prison interview with him, and they just won't allow it at this point.
Certainly is one of the more horrific characters in Canadian history, Russell Williams. The book is called Camouflaged Killer, The Shocking Double Life of Colonel Russell Williams. It's written by David A. Gibb. People can check out the website, which is www.camouflagedkiller.com. David, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thank you, Peter. I appreciate it.
David A. Gibb, author of Camouflaged Killer, The Shocking Double Life of Colonel Russ Williams. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0117, and you'll find links to David's website and also links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
The surveillance video shows the crime. A man smashed the window of a market in Nashua, New Hampshire, and stole a large quantity of cigarettes. Then two women who witnessed the crime decided that was a good idea, and they were seen coming in for cigarettes too. It does not appear that the male is associated with the two females, a police spokesperson said, but afterward, one of the women called police to report the break-in. Once police saw the video, the two women, Marietta Sparrow, age 36, and Amanda Primo, age 25, were arrested and charged with felony burglary. The man in the video is still being sought. Why would someone who is just basically looting from a store then call the cops to report a robbery? One reason, and one reason only, they're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0117. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And on the website, you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0117. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.